Welcome to the Global Heart Podcast. I'm Pablo Perel, Senior Science Advisor at the World Heart Federation. Joining me today as co-host is Dr. Raul Santos, Editor-in-Chief of Global Heart. Raul, great to have you.
Thank you very much, Pablo. It's great to be here again.
So today we're talking about something that is not in the headlines anymore, COVID-19, with a focus on long COVID in particular and its relationship with cardiovascular disease. And to discuss about this, we are delighted to welcome two fantastic guests. We have Professor Karen Sliwa, Director of the Cape Heart Institute at the University of Cape Town, South Africa, and also a former president of the World Heart Federation. Welcome, Karen.
Thank you very much, Pablo. It's really a pleasure to be here.
Welcome, Karen. And also we have Professor Ami Banerjee from University College London, who also has strong links with WHF. He's a former emerging leader, and now he's a WHF board member. So welcome, Ami.
Nice to be here, Pablo. Looking forward to the discussion.
So for today, we want to structure the discussion around three papers that you were involved. The first one is the WHF Global COVID-19 Long-Term Follow-Up Study that was published in Global Heart, and Karen was leading. But also there are two other papers that, Ami, you've been working, and they're quite interesting. One, a Nature paper on vaccination and prevention of long COVID, and a more recent one published in BMJ Open about long-term follow-up in a specialist post-COVID service in the UK. So we will include the links to these papers at the bottom of the podcast. So before getting to the papers, Ami, let me start with you, as you've been working a lot on this topic. And what is long COVID, and why, even if it's not in the headlines anymore, is still a major public health issue?
Thank you, Pablo. Long COVID is the latest of the so-called post-viral syndromes or post-viral conditions, also increasingly known as post-acute infection syndromes. So long COVID was defined by WHO and other stakeholders as 12 weeks or more of symptoms after the initial infection. And this is still important because although the incidence of infection, the severity of infection has dropped, there are still people in most countries who are still affected, you know, maybe off work, maybe unable to pursue their activities of daily living because of this disease. And so it's important to still be aware of that. But also it could teach us about what to do the next time we're faced by this kind of pandemic challenge.
Thanks very much, Ami. Now, moving on to Karen. Karen, it's great to have you here. Before we go into your paper that was published in Global Heart, is still COVID and long COVID relevant to the cardiologists? And if so, why is that?
Yes. Thank you for your question. I think it's very relevant. I mean, for several reasons. I mean, first is that I still see patients in my practice who are complaining with those subtle but very disabling symptoms. So I think it's important that cardiologists, but also general physicians, are aware of what long COVID symptoms are. You have to rule out other diseases, which can also lead to fatigue and being short of breath. But if you can't find any of those factors, it's very important to acknowledge that those symptoms are real. It's very important for the patient to get acknowledgement of that they are ill and that is something real making them ill. So that's the one important aspect why people need to know about it. And the second is, it's more general, that physicians and cardiologists need to know about the post-viral symptoms in general, also with flu or other viral strains, because it's particularly common in certain risk populations, and we come later to that. But in general, in older people and people with cardiovascular comorbidities, that means hypertension, diabetes, a previous myocardial infarction with bypass surgery. So you need in your head be able to red flag certain people and focus on that those risk factors for cardiovascular disease also increase your chance to get more severe viral infection, including COVID-19, but also other flu like adenovirus and other flu-like illnesses. Thank you.
So people who have risk factors for cardiovascular disease or already have cardiovascular disease are more fragile people, right? And as you said, they might get a more severe viral disease and its consequences, but also I think the viral disease can also bring worse things for the cardiovascular diseases already there, right? So I think it's, and now fortunately we have vaccination. Many people got infection in the past, so we're stronger against COVID. But this issue of the long COVID is still very relevant. And I really like you to talk a little bit about the paper that you published in Global Heart to have that brings us an idea of how we're living with this COVID nowadays with long COVID. What was the impact? So I think your paper was very nice. And can you talk a little bit about it?
Yes. So first, I want to really acknowledge this was an initiative by the World Heart Federation, but together with several other members, in particular the Global Health Institute in India and the World Health Organization, who also provided technical advice and some other support. And it was based on patients. So how it worked, and that's very important, via the World Heart Federation, we reached out to the World Heart Federation member countries, and that included a very large number of low to middle income countries. So in that sense, the study is unique. Then we had altogether a total of about 2,500 patients with hospitalized COVID-19, and they were from 16 countries, and they were followed up. We looked at the 1 month, 3 months, 6 months, and 9 months follow up, and we documented exactly on what type of virus infection they had. And also on how they were managed in the hospital and afterwards. So what we have found is that the majority of the patients were from low to middle income countries, which was about 60%, about half were male and the other female, and a relatively young population with a mean age of 59. And it was, and most of the patients, more than 50%, actually had a positive test for COVID-19, and we had a specific strain. And Omicron strain was the most prevalent, 98%. And then we followed up the patient and documented if they were short of breath, had fatigue, anxiety, chest pain, palpitation. And what we found that about half of the patient experienced one of the major long COVID symptoms at 1 month, and then one quarter still reported persistent long COVID symptoms at 9 to 12 months. So it really a substantial number of cases. Then we looked at 33% reported persistent anxiety and depression. And 23% had issues with mobility. What is important is that we found a higher than expected mortality. I mean, most of us thought that Omicron, the viral strain Omicron, would not be such a severe disease because it started slower, we had lower numbers of hospitalization, but we found altogether and a mortality rate, so people dying at 9 to 12 months of 15%, which is really substantial. Then when we looked at the risk factors, so or who were particularly prone to get long COVID symptoms, so it was more common in females. It was definitely more common in people who had pre-existing illnesses like hypertension, diabetes, or being overweight. And those ones who had more severe illness. So if you had to go to ICU while you're admitted, you were longer in an ICU, then you also had a higher chance to get COVID-19. We also identified that certain populations, and in particular Hispanics, had a higher chance to get long COVID symptoms. And altogether, for the entire group, people who are older than 70 had a 13 times higher chance to get long COVID than if you were younger than 50. So in summary of the paper, we found that a study showed a substantial burden of morbidity and mortality in a quarter of the patients with persistent long COVID symptoms up to 1 year. And that is important in particular because we had a high percentage of patients from low-income countries where we had only limited data.
So I think the results are quite striking, especially when we talk about higher mortality, not only the worse quality of life, and clearly shows that this disease is still unfortunately very important for the health of all of us, and especially our more fragile patients. Considering the results, Karen, especially for the low middle income countries, what do you think how this paper could help us, let's say, in managing this situation? I mean, greater prevention, greater identification. How do you think that this paper can help guide us on the policy on dealing with this situation?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is. We have clearly learned lessons from the COVID pandemic, and this is now my personal opinion, the lessons which I take from them. So it's not WHO or World Health Federation or anything, but you might all remember that some countries had a very strict lockdown. A country where I come from, South Africa, had a severe lockdown, but for a short time. Because in this country, people really have to work and continue working, and they need an income, and the country needs to be productive. So, looking back now, let's say we would get a similar pandemic with a similar virulent strain. I think in South Africa, based on the data we have, it would take an approach to really suggest that elderly people, so above the age of 70, perhaps quarantine and not leave the house, but younger people will still continue working because that's simply what some low to middle income countries have to do. And I think also the health message that really continue working on prevention of gaining weight, managing your blood pressure, risk factor profiling is anyhow extremely important. I mean, and in the context of a viral infection as well. So I think this is for me the take-home lessons from the study, but altogether, like how we live in future with another pandemic.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Karen. And I think we can, and Raul, we can do a whole episode on how we prepare, I mean, from the cardiovascular perspective for new pandemics that they will come for sure. I think that's a fascinating and there's a lot of debate about that and a lot of lessons learned. So let's move to your paper, Sammy. You've been working a lot on COVID, and I would like to focus on mainly two of your recent papers, but maybe you want to talk about something else on this topic. But in particular, I'm interested to talk about the Nature Communications Systematic Review that you published recently. Can you share with the audience what was the main question and why was important to do that systematic review?
Thank you, Pablo. In terms of trying to tackle the COVID challenge, vaccination has emerged as our main weapon, if you like, and we didn't know what the evidence suggests in terms of stopping long COVID. And that was what we set out to do in this systematic review to find out, does COVID vaccination have any impact on new long COVID? And there's observational evidence. We found 31 studies that were there, but not clinical trials, to look at whether what we call primary vaccination, the first time you have vaccination, or booster vaccinations reduce the risk of long COVID. And the answer is that, in short, having COVID vaccination clearly reduces your risk. not only of COVID infection, but also long COVID, which I guess is how we would expect. And also, when you have booster vaccination, that also reduces your risk of long COVID, both compared with people who've only had the primary vaccination and people who are unvaccinated.
That, I mean, is mainly by, I mean, did you find if it's clear evidence about, is that by decreasing the severity of COVID, or there are other mechanisms that the hypothesize how the vaccination works on the prevention of long COVID?
I think that's almost definitely what the route would be. So vaccination, it doesn't stop infection, but it reduces the risk of having an infection. It reduces the severity of the infection. You know, at one end is hospitalization and mortality, but also even the symptoms in the community are less in vaccinated people than unvaccinated. And we now add that people who are vaccinated have less incidence of the longer term complications, which we call long COVID.
Yeah, and I guess, I mean, that might also help at the policy level in terms of uptake, maybe when we're seeing, I mean, resistance sometimes for vaccination. But before going to more broader questions, I would like to hear from both of you in terms of research agendas. The other paper I was interested to hear about is this recent paper you published this year in BMJ, where you're looking at the follow-up of a specialist COVID clinic. I mean, this is a UK experience. Can you tell us a little bit more about this study? What were the main findings and any kind of concrete implication for how service should be organized?
Thank you. This is our specialist post-COVID or long COVID service at University College London Hospital, led by my colleague, Dr. Melissa Heitman, who is a respiratory physician who, like many of us, ended up in the pandemic following the route where the clinical burden was. And she was initially seeing people who were post ITU and post-hospitalized, but this clinic was set up in April 2020. You might ask how a cardiologist ended up in COVID, and I'm an epidemiologist by training, and so I was interested in the high-risk groups, including people with cardiovascular disease and the risk of hospitalization and mortality, and that led us to work together. So myself and Dr. Heitman have been working together since then. So this is the largest specialist post-COVID service that we're aware of, definitely in the UK. It's an experience over the last 5 years of the people that passed through that service and their outcomes. Importantly, I think that long COVID is a diagnosis of exclusion. It's a clinical diagnosis. We don't have biomarkers for it. So part of this service is the importance of ruling out other things, including cardiovascular disease, including coexisting respiratory disease. So good old-fashioned general medicine that's linked up and multidisciplinary, it shows the power of that. And also, I think a take-home from this paper is the persistence of symptoms and the proportion of people who are still having impairment such that they might not be back at work. But then there are, if I was to tell a good news story, that you know there are people who are recovering, and there's things that make you more likely to recover. And relevant to the last discussion point, vaccination is one of them. Even if it's after your COVID infection, getting vaccinated seems to increase your chances of recovering from long COVID. So I think at policy level, there's room for joined up services for specialist input in these patients, and also there is a route to recovery. No, it's just last thing I'd say, Pablo, is that there's very little in terms of pandemic planning in any of our countries for post-infectious disease. And I think long COVID shows that we should, at the very least, be modelling or preparing for it, because this has been a major burden worldwide, which we kind of ended up developing services and seeing people on the hoof where we were more prepared for the acute.
Thank you. I mean, yeah, and we're coming back. How we prepare for the next pandemic that I'm sure will come, it's definitely something we can would be interesting to discuss also in another podcast. One concrete finding from this paper, if I'm correct, I mean, I think there was, for me at least, some counterintuitive finding regarding hospitalized and non-hospitalized patients. No? Can you expand a little bit on that?
Yes. So in the long COVID or post-COVID space, people have often differentiated between the people who were admitted to hospital and the people who were in the community, non-hospitalized. Of course, being hospitalized is very context dependent. It might be dependent on whether I see my symptoms as severe enough to go to hospital. It might be whether I'm near enough to a hospital and know what when I should present to hospital, whereas some people might be quicker to present to hospital. So, discounting that clear confounder, you would expect that being hospitalized means you've got more severe infection, more severe long COVID. But actually, people who are non-hospitalized in some ways had more persistent symptoms and less functional recovery. That's challenging to understand why that might be. It could be tied to the more intense treatment that you get if you are hospitalized post-infection. And so hitting the infection hard early on leads to more chance of recovery or lesser symptoms. Potentially that's a hypothesis. Whereas in the non-hospitalized, you might recover off your own steam, so to speak. And it also might be that there's different grades of infection or different types of inflammation happening in and as we have tried so far really unsuccessfully to subtype people with long COVID. This is our crudest tool, people who go into hospital and people who don't. So trying to look at the underlying mechanisms. There's lots of ongoing work in different labs in different countries to try and understand better how to kind of differentiate these different types of long COVID.
Ami, I have a question for you and Karen as well, because as you said, the chronic inflammation, right, that is associated with this disease. Now there's a huge effort in developing anti-inflammatory therapies for people who already have atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease, or people who have CKD or HFpEF, heart failure with preserved ejection fraction. We have three big trials that are going on. And I keep wondering how this long COVID, how this could impact, on the outcomes of cardiovascular disease, because inflammation has a lot to do with this, the pathophysiology of this disease. And though we have robust evidence that people who are inflamed have higher CRP levels, have a greater risk of complications in these settings. So, how do you guys see how to reduce this? Because we have to avoid that people get a more severe infectious viral disease that can lead to inflammation. So, and we're talking, I guess, prevention is still very, very important here. So, maybe talking about healthier lifestyle or vaccination, extremely important to block the long-term inflammation. Can you comment that a little bit? Because now we're going to come, let's say, with interesting therapies, but probably very expensive. And I guess prevention could do a lot of good things before we need to really treat our patients with pharmacological therapy to block inflammation.
I'll start and then let Karen come in. I think that we've known for many years, many decades, that there's a two-way link between infections and cardiovascular disease. So infections predispose to a risk of future cardiovascular disease. And if I have cardiovascular disease, I'm likely to have a more severe infection with whatever the infectious agent is. That's the case with COVID. And so actually there's good observational data to suggest that if you prevent cardiovascular disease, if you treat cardiovascular disease better, then the risk of infection, the severity of infection, the risk of long COVID seems to improve. So integrated care, we work in a very siloed and sub-specialized world, but actually treating underlying conditions helps with the infection, but also the other way round, that as you were alluding to, people with long COVID or post-COVID are more likely to have cardiovascular disease. And so observational data from COVID vaccination at national level, our group has done some of this work, suggests that there are lower rates of cardiovascular disease in people who have COVID vaccination, even people with long COVID. So I think, we should at the very least be looking at risk factors in people with long COVID and vice versa. Over to you, Karen.
Yes, I would like to make a comment to non-pharmacological management. And there are very good data showing that if you are physically active, it lowers your inflammatory cytokines. And I mean, I really think, our thinking has changed already. If you look at hospitalization for many conditions like pneumonia or for other diseases, the hospital may become shorter. It is our understanding that it is actually definitely not a good idea for humans being to lie flat in a bed unnecessarily for a very prolonged time. And if you look at the data, even from the paper I presented, 8% of the patient died within 1 year of pulmonary embolus. So being sedentary or in a bed is clearly increasing your risk for any thrombotic event. So where our research is missing is to understand if people who have not, I don't imply someone who's very ill should walk around, but someone who has a moderate illness, if you keep walking, it is likely to bring your inflammation down, and it's likely to reduce your chance to get a thrombotic event. And there we have not enough information. The same with cold water swimming. If you cool your body down, it clearly reduces your inflammation. So there are options. I know there's not much money in non-medical therapy, but I really think that is something which should be researched and could be really applied on a broad level in also lower income countries.
Yeah, I think the adequate lifestyle, it's a real, let's say, defense that we might have against inflammation and cardiovascular disease. I think it's extremely, because now we're living in a, let's say, world that obesity is everywhere, and obesity is extremely pro-inflammatory, and we know that it's complicated to lose weight. But physical activity is something that we can do, right? And I think this can make a lot of difference regarding the health of people. So, Karen, just to wrap it up on the paper that you published, very important paper in Global Heart. I'm very happy that you chose our journal to publish that. In the practical point of view, what would be the messages that you could bring to clinicians regarding how we can see nowadays COVID and post-COVID? What would be the implications of that in a clinical point of view, and how to deal with these situations?
As I mentioned before, I think it's most important that you recognize that long COVID exists and how it can present. So mainly fatigue is the highest proportion, breathlessness, and anxiety, a very important aspect which is really not much known. And then secondly, to understand that risk factor profile management, including physical activity and not eating processed food, will reduce your chance to get cardiovascular disease, but also reduce your chance to get severe other conditions, including viral infections. So this is for me really the key message. The third one, which I really think is not getting enough attention, your chance after a severe illness or moderate illness that you have a tremendous high chance for up to a year to get a thromboembolic event. And it's very important. Again, physical activity will help to reduce that chance. And if you have other factors contributing, anticoagulation is a different topic, but that can be should also be considered in specific population groups.
Thank you, Karen. And we are almost finishing this very interesting conversation. But before asking my final question and following what you were discussing, I think all of us, we work and we believe in prevention and a population approach. But is there any role in particular for people that have cardiovascular disease and they get COVID, regardless of prevention, we'll still have people that will get COVID of any evidence or recommendation regarding antivirals in this population for people with cardiovascular disease? I don't know, Ami, what's the approach in the UK, where I guess there will be available the use of antivirals in people with COVID and CVD.
I don't know that there is specific guidance, if there is specific guidance for people with cardiovascular disease, but people who have severe infection, who have risk factors, are eligible for antivirals. But that's a case-by-case decision by clinicians. Interestingly, at the moment, people with cardiovascular disease are not listed for COVID vaccination this past winter. In the UK, it's only people who are aged over 75. That reflects a changing situation as COVID waves have become less virulent and the long COVID has become less common. And so I guess from a health economic stance, that decision has been made. But I think that's reassessed year by year. But yeah, in terms of antivirals, I don't think the specific guidance.
Particularly for vaccination, I know the EU, I think they are including and they highlighted people with cardiovascular disease. So that's something that I think as World Health Federation, I think it's important that we keep advocating for identifying this high-risk population for everything, for prevention and treatment. And I think it's something we can definitely do better.
Particularly in the global context where there is a lot of misinformation and a lot of anti-vaccination feeling, I think it's important not just to think of COVID vaccination. So actually, flu vaccination has class one recommendation in guidelines in people with cardiovascular disease. And that should be, thought of at the same time as well.
Another podcast, Raul, to do on misinformation. I'm sure it will be fascinating. To finish, I wanted to ask about research priorities, but in a way, you covered that already in many of your answers. So I would ask maybe to you, Karen, first. As you've been, a champion of research in low and middle income countries, the example of the study you present, but beyond that, why we need to do, many people, if you want to say, well, low and middle income countries, you don't have many resources. You shouldn't be doing research. You just implement. So I know it's a question that I can imagine the answer, but I would like to hear why we need to do research in LMICs and what's the relevance of that? With the example of COVID and beyond.
Yeah, look, thank you, Pablo. I mean, we really need research, and there is a lot of research in low to middle income countries. So, and why it's important, because first, the risk factor profile differs in different populations, and in you have limited resources in most parts of the world, by the way. So if you don't have data, you cannot come up with pragmatic and cost-effective solutions. So you need the data to then make a decision how you invest in the re with the resources you have in the best way. And without research, that's not possible. If you take data from another continent, you will most likely spend your money and your efforts in a not very efficient way for your own population.
Thank you. And I think at Global Heart, we are trying to definitely to promote that. Before I ask you a final question to both of you, but the final question for you, Ami, because also I know this is your passion, is about silos and how to break the silos. Do you think that COVID made a change in the way we do research, for example, in terms of cardiovascular disease, infectious disease, why we need to break that silo and what had happened since COVID?
Thank you, Pablo. The simple answer is yes, but we haven't necessarily learned and maintained all our lessons. I'm definitely a product of that. I had no business working in COVID and infectious diseases, and I had to either clinically or because of curiosity or need shift my research focus. But it turns out that, the example I gave, flu vaccination. Many of our cardiology colleagues ignore that bit of the European or other guidelines. And yet, in terms of effect sizes, it's as good as any other God-fearing cardiovascular treatment that we give for cardiovascular prevention. And that's really because of the silo. Yeah. I, as a cardiologist, think it's the primary care or infectious disease doctor's problem, and they think the same about cardiovascular disease. So yeah, definitely. We need to join up more going forward, not just clinically, but research-wise. And that's where I think there's a lot of discovery and translation to be done as well.
Thank you, Amen. So the final question that we always ask all our guests, very briefly, I know it's challenging. We want to hear from you in one sentence. What do you understand by global cardiovascular research?
Obviously, a very broad field, but my understanding is really that you do research locally and compare globally, and the lessons are shared globally.
Excellent. And Ami?
I really can't do better than Karen. I would only add that there's something in global cardiovascular research which is about equity. So we're trying to do something that benefits everybody, even as Karen says, even if it is local, we're trying to think how it could be scaled up to help everybody.
Thank you. I mean, and the leadership of Raul as editor-in-chief, that's what we are trying to promote at Global Heart, improving global cardiovascular research. Ami, Karen, many thanks. It has been a real pleasure speaking with you, Raul. Thanks for co-hosting. Again, to our listeners, we'll link the papers in the show notes. You'll have access to the three papers. Be sure to subscribe whenever. Wherever you listen, and thanks as always for listening to the Global Heart podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.